You're listening to episode 101 of the Play Therapy Community Podcast.
Welcome to Play Therapy Community Podcast, providing connection, information, and inspiration to child therapists all around the world. Here's your host, a licensed psychotherapist, a registered play therapist, and my mom, Jackie Flynn.
Hi there. Thank you so much for joining me in another episode of Play Therapy Community Podcast. Well, before we get started in our conversation today, I want to tell you about Marshall's Miniatures. Marshall's Miniatures, they have a subscription there. He makes these handmade little miniatures. He was telling me one time that he doesn't make all of them. He makes some of them, but it really, it's each one of them's kind of unique. I have a few of them in my collection. I've been to his workshop in Austin, and I love it. I took a work training on dissociation there, and it was a game changer for me. He has all of these different shapes of sand trays, and it's really small. He has like healthy food, and it's just quite the experience. I really went there for training, but I left feeling like I had my own therapy, so it was so good. So if you would like to learn more about Marshall's Miniatures, just go to marshalllyles.com. Well, I'm excited about today's conversation. I'm actually in conversation with Marshall Lyles himself. So, Marshall, before we get started, let me have you just introduce yourself. Just tell people who you are and what you do.
Sure. It's good to be with you again, friend.
Good to be with you.
I'm a marriage and family therapist and a professional counselor in Austin, Texas. And I have historically worked with families impacted by attachment trauma and medical trauma. I am a play therapist and primarily do expressive arts work. Sand tray, poetry, and clay are my three favorites. And then I teach some and I write some, but I'm gonna be entering into a year other than, you know, some agencies that I'm gonna be doing some CE events for that I'd already signed contracts for, like Water's Edge in Arkansas. I'll be doing some expressive arts, and then some of our state chapters, APTs, I'll be doing some events. But everything else next year is me taking a break from clinical work and supervision and just doing some retreats for healers.
Oh, I love that. I have to say, I know it wasn't a retreat, the training that I went to, but it felt like a retreat. I can imagine what a real retreat is. I have learned more from you than perhaps anyone that I've ever consulted with. There's such deep wisdom and there's such humanity in your work. So the thought of you taking a pause to offer retreats for healers is just magical. There is a little part of me like, oh no, who am I going to consult with? Because you're my go-to. But I'm excited to see what it turns into. You're such a gift to our community, to the world, really.
Oh, that's very, very kind of you. And I hit a place, you know, probably related to the topics we'll be getting into today, but I knew from a place of responsibility, I needed to just create a little bit more pause in my life and then only do the work that was compatible with my own healing and rest. And so that's the plan for, you know, the big caveat is as long as it can be financially sustainable. You know, it's all theory for now, but I'm hopeful that there'll be a place, and I really hope it'll be mutually beneficial, that maybe there are people in the community who need a place to go to do their own inventory and a reflection, and need a supportive community environment to do that. And plus, you know, Austin's just kind of fun to come to.
It sure is. Especially if you have Claudio Campo driving you around.
We'll put in that request. She's going to be our official retreat Uber.
She's so fun. We ate the food there is fun. We ate the best food. The artwork is amazing. And your workshops, just even going to the workshop is an experience. Now, when will registration for those retreats open up? Like, I mean, what will the
They're
information
all
be?
open. I will say that the first half of the year, maybe a little bit more, they're all full. But we've opened the ones for the second half of the year. Some of them are Santre focused, and some of them are poetry focused. Some are more general expressive work, but also a couple of them are very specifically about how do we start to confront the internalized ableism that we've inherited from the world that might be impacting our own healing and our roles as healers? So I'm most excited probably about those right now.
Oh, I love it. Okay, so that jumps right into our conversation today. And I'm really, really eager to learn because I think a lot of times we don't know what we don't know. And sometimes we can stumble on things that are hurtful, maybe disrespectful, without even being aware of it. And sometimes we are aware of it. So can you kind of let us know what we need to know specifically about on the topic of disablism. Is that how I say it?
Yeah, there are two words. There's ableism and there's disablism. And then sometimes in the literature, you'll see them written so that it's DIS and then a slash, and then ableism, which is meant to kind of capture both terms. So ableism is about bias that's in favor of able-bodied and able-minded people. And disablism is about bias that is against people with disabilities. And so it's are we trying to design a world or overlooking disability in favor of the normies, of the normates, of the able-bodied, able-minded? That would be ableism. Or are we actively holding on to attitudes, ideas, practices that are making the experience of being disabled harder? That would be disablism. So there's a lot of crossover, of course, between the two.
Absolutely. And I'm thinking, gosh, applies to everything, whether it's just social situations, business ventures, educational opportunities, specifically in child therapy. Like, as therapists, we work with so many different people. And not only do we not want to cause harm, of course, we want to do good. What do we need to know to really make sure that we're being respectful and honorable and just honoring humanity?
Love the question. That's wonderful. The first thing is just like we're learning with so many different aspects of culture and identity, disability is a socially constructed concept that people with different impairments, or all of us in the range of being different in mind, different in body from one another, an impairment doesn't have to equal a disability. It becomes a disability when there's a lack of inclusivity or a lack of accommodation available. So the thing that always makes me saddest in our field of mental health is when we aren't acknowledging ways that we might be increasing what it feels like to have a disability. So if they come into contact with our offices or our practices and they can feel more disabled because there's less available inclusivity. And I think when people come into contact with us, there's an inherent greater expectation that we will know how to manage inclusivity. So when you encounter someone who's meant to be a healer and they don't have that awareness, you can get more of a sense of feeling disabled in those moments. But if the world was designed and if therapy was designed in a way where differences and struggles were already prepared for and acknowledged and welcomed, then those things wouldn't have to necessarily feel like a disability. And so that knowing how to have conversations, knowing how to rearrange your space, knowing how to not rescue, not infantilize, not use microaggressive language. Those are all steps that therapists can be taking personally to check out their own implicit bias that we've all inherited, including me, who I've, you know, had a disability since I was born. And I have internalized ableism. I have judgments against those own parts of myself that I have to check out so that they don't then become judgments that are imposed on others.
So good. So, okay. So first of all, I want to kind of define infantilized. I've never heard that term. And the thought of that sometimes, you know, if we don't have things set up in a certain way or processes, or even just like the logistics, it could make someone feel like not good enough or less than or disabled. Whereas if we have those, it's just like, you know, we're all people and this is the way it's set up, but everyone can have access to whatever's available here in your opinion.
Because one of the most common questions I get, Jackie, around that is, how do you design a truly accessible space? It's hard, you know, because people's different impairments and different traits and different qualities that they navigate life with could actually cause them to need things in a therapeutic space that would be the exact opposite of what the next client might need, you know. So it's very much being prepared. Even if we think about in the world of neurodiversity, some people thrive on stimulation and their neurodiverse presentation, and others are incredibly overwhelmed by it. And so it's probably best to just try to have spaces where there's room for adaptation, and there's room to make things lower or raise things up or spread things apart, where there's a way that a chair can face towards something or away from something based on how it's being received by the client. And so we've got to try and design spaces that can just be easily adapted from person to person. It's really hard when you do something like Santre in particular. I think Santre is probably even harder than general play to have rooms that feel inclusive, because it is so many items, you know, that take up room, and yet, you know, we can be thoughtful about how we set those things up.
Gosh, as you're even describing that, that's first thing that came to mind, is Santre and all the miniatures and everything on the wall. But I'm thinking about your workshop. You know, as you're describing this, I'm thinking that's exactly the way that you've done it. There is a really busy area of your workshop, and then there's like what I think of as like a meditational area with the cushions that's very calm and not a lot of stuff. And then you have the couches, and everything can be moved around. There's nothing that's too high. So if someone had, you know, limited reachability, then they could access whatever. And also the tables, you have it to where chairs can be moved away and somebody could just kind of just fit right in there if they needed to with a wheelchair.
Yeah, where tables can raise or lower, we can get down on the ground if that's what's needed, or we can be up, you know, chair height. Yeah, that I know I have a luxury of space here that I know not all people in all parts of the country, you know, get to have. And so I think it gets more complicated when you're working in small spaces to how to figure out. So the other thing that we can do is just be really transparent on our websites and in our marketing, you know, to describe our space as well, so that can be another criteria that people can evaluate whether or not it's going to be a fit for them. You know, just we can all be honest about where we work and where we practice. And then, you know, if we're willing, even if someone is near us, if they're needing virtual as an accommodation, are we being really upfront about how that works? And so, yeah, there are definite ways to make sure that we're giving enough information that clients can feel comfortable opting in or opting out.
Okay, so clear communication about what we have to offer in our space and our just set up in a way that they can determine whether this is, you know, for me or not, and they have that predictability of what to expect.
Absolutely. So lots of pictures on our website. And then, you know, for people who are visually impaired, then making sure that we've described the pictures so that their software that reads, you know, can always have a sense of what's being visually represented. You know, there are so many extra steps that we can take that just mean so much to communities. It's hard to describe if you haven't lived with a lot of impairments, what it feels like to live in a world that tries not to see you, than to have a moment of someone seeing you and thinking ahead of you. It's disconfirming, you know, that's therapeutic. Even if someone then doesn't get to take advantage of the services that we offer, if they need to rule out for some reason, they feel empowered that they got enough information that they didn't have to risk being disappointed or starting something that was yet another, difficult topic to navigate.
You're really kind of, you know, thinking in terms of like cognition, I matter, I'm safe, and I can trust.
Yeah.
I can trust that someone is going, especially a healing professional, is going to be mindful of my experience and it, you know, let me make an informed decision of whether this has what I need or not. And through pictures, it seems like such a minimal effort for such great, you know, experience for whoever is in searching through the website to see if there is anything that can even help them.
Oh, 100%. There was a man who came here the other day. I was just cleaning, and so I had my door open. I was out going out into the yard quite frequently to wash out some pottery buckets, and an unhoused man had come around the corner, and he very like tentatively asked permission to use the water hose to fill up his water jugs. And I was like, yeah, but there's sink inside that's deep, and so why don't you go inside? And he was like, no, that's okay. And I was like, seriously, the doors are open, just go help yourself. And then I also told him that, you know, we just had an event, so all the food was still out, so grab whatever you needed.
Aww.
And when I came in, he was crying. And so I went over to talk to him, and he said, most of the time I live a life where people stare or they pretend like they don't see me. Like, you don't get the in-between. And I thought that was such a description for how many disabled people and, you know, probably people of color in certain communities and maybe LGBTQ, like that is such a universal sensation for marginalized people. I don't get to feel safe because you're either pretending to not see me or you're seeing me through a lens that I can feel is scary, through the glare, through the stare. And that in-between place is craved. Like, I just want to be witnessed. You know, just want to be witnessed.
Yeah. So I think, goodness, there's so much to that. But I think about like even like homeless people, you know, you ignored, just kind of not even make eye contact. Some people just kind of walk by and pretend like they don't exist to not even have the respect to look and to witness, to be seen.
Yeah.
Wow.
To give a smile, and then that goes to the word you wanted to find, to not infantilize. Infantilizing is the microaggression of where we speak to someone as if they are younger than they are, because we're making assumptions about their ability based on their appearance. And so, it's often really common. You imagine, you know, a teenager in a wheelchair, and then someone gets down and uses kind of a baby voice to talk to them, assuming that they have some sort of developmental struggle automatically. Those are little moments of, not even little, those are microaggressions where, you know, you are communicating to someone a judgment you have about their internal world based on their appearance.
Oh, imagine what it'd like be like to be on the other end of that. Wow, that seems like so kind of dehumanizing and differentiating. I think about the guy coming in to fill up the bucket, and then you have the food out there. That's so beautiful. I can imagine it was probably like, wow, I just met such a kind soul.
He is. You can just feel his special. Like he just kind of walks around with a sense of it, because I've gotten to talk to him less than that a few times more. And then the other day he came by after that and walked by the front yard and just waved through the window. So I'm like, I think we're friends now. Oh. I think we graduated to friendship.
Oh, I love it. Oh my goodness. You have such kindness in your heart and such wisdom too. Now I'm thinking
I know that you'll think this is silly. You probably won't think it's silly. There's something I feel so lucky. Like I've inherited a building that does the work. You know, there's something like it. It's like that house in Encanto. You know, it just like says, come here. You know, we've got room for you. And so there is something about this lovely building that I get to come to every day.
There is, and it's unexplainable. The walls, it's so colorful, the space, and just to give a shout out to the people in Texas, I don't think I've ever been treated so nice. I like made some really amazing friends while I was there. I truly felt like I had a retreat experience. I'm surely gonna do one of your retreats, like if there's an opening. It's funny though, and I know I'm getting off on a tangent, but when I signed up for that training, I didn't even really look for what it was about, because I was like, your trainings fill up so quickly that I'm going to take one of Marshall's trainings and I can't wait. So I just signed up. And then when I started getting the emails, I was like, oh, what is it on now?
You came to the most intense event.
And I yield. I stuck a pirate in that sand and some things changed in my world.
All it takes is a pirate.
Hey, the thought of like the food and everything and all of that, you sent emails, like even in your emails that you sent for the trainings, I knew kind of that there were snacks. I had visual of like what the seating was going to be like. I knew the agenda. I could imagine that's all part of kind of what you're describing now. Like I could predict, if I was gluten intolerant, I knew that you were going to offer some gluten-free foods. And I knew that there would be space for me to move around, that you don't have classroom seating. So to me, it kind of sounds like that's what you're describing.
Yeah, that's the hope, and I know in our chat today, we've been mainly talking about how ableism and disableism impacts clients. But the longer I'm in this field and the more I talk about these subjects, I'm realizing how many therapists have felt excluded from the broader community, but trainings are harder for some people because of, neurodiverse needs or somatic needs. And not knowing if they're going to be welcomed or accommodated, or even if their accommodations are going to be met with hostility or irritation. And grad school is so hard for new therapists with disabilities. And there are standards that are set, in our field that have an ableist undertone, and even not like written standards, even some of our like unwritten norms, that really kind of say, if you have an impairment, there's a burden on you to prove your competence more than somebody who's able-bodied or typically minded, that is really problematic.
Absolutely. And how is it even related, competence? It doesn't even sound logical. Wow. And in grad school, I'm thinking about like trainings that I go to, literally, if there's, this very kind of deep stuff, I have to get up and move every 20 minutes. I just have to, with ADHD, like I literally can't sit still or else I'm going to explode. So being able to even just leave the training can be very, but in no way is it related to competence, That's right. Interesting that there would even be a connection in some people's mind to that.
It is such a deep judgment that's a part of, especially here in US culture. So if you think of therapists who maybe have a speech difference, people who speak differently are chronically being assumed to be intellectually diminished in some way. And so that there's this kind of burden of proof of competence that comes on. Or if you are in a wheelchair, or fill in the blank, you know, that there is just this pairing, and it's a hard bias to get people to be comfortable to look at, to get a field, to get a culture to look at, because in my opinion, people don't want to have to think about, none of our minds or bodies are permanent. You know, everyone is going to be in a state of decline. And so it's to acknowledge that the world is more built through an ableist lens means you also kind of have to acknowledge that at some point you're going to have to be on the receiving end of that struggle. And mm-hmm. it is just easier to pretend like that's not the reality. And so it's a tough sell to get people to want to look at these parts.
Mm-hmm. And to be able to look inside and say, what am I doing? You know, before we started recording today, we talked about, like, if someone is raised in an environment where things are normalized that are very disabling, very disrespectful, very dehumanizing, people may even go into businesses and, you know, do things a certain way, not realizing. What would you say to somebody that maybe needs to, it's curious about, like, how do I learn more? Where do I get support as far as, you know, setting up my practice or creating experience for my customer or my client that is really honoring the human that they are?
Do you know, just like with all the other areas that we need to be increasing our own awareness and implicit bias monitoring, find someone who's from the community you're maybe needing to explore potential judgments about, and that advertises themselves as providing consultation in that area, and then pay them. You know, like there's this kind of history of us taking from others. And so if I'm wanting to work on looking at my internalized racism and how that might be affecting my therapeutic practice, then there are a number of clinicians of color who advertise that as a consultation that they provide. And so go there, invest in that. The same with if you're looking at internalized ableism, it's easily discoverable to find people who are willing to help you in that exploration. It's also great to try and do it within a group. So, you know, if you're someone who could put together a book club for therapists, and having, you know, four or six of you get together, there are any of a number of amazing books on this. Just pick one and then read it in community and talk about, you know, the awareness that you're developing. Reading the books on your own is also a great start. But there's a little bit of a lack of accountability when you don't have to take it to dialogue. So mm-hmm. moving it to a relational setting where you're having to interact with the material, I think allows it to become a little bit more felt. So that those would be easy starting points. There are some even like assessments online that you can find about looking at implicit bias around disability and ability and those kinds of subjects. There are some canned trainings around that subject area that you can find. And, you know, retreats like I offer, and there are others that do it where you go in and it's not a formal training. It's more of a personal discovery experience. You know, if you're someone who has a little bit of luxury of time and extra money that you don't have to have everything be a continuing education venture, go do some personal work or find a therapist to do some of your work with in that area.
I love it. Personal responsibility, the integrity mm-hmm. piece. I love it. Book clubs and reach out to people for support and get therapy. And sounds like just becoming a better human and educating yourself where education's needed. Oh, that's so good. Just on a side note, Claudia has been telling me about a book club that she's running right now. She gets so excited. I love to hear her speak. Claudia Ocampo, I know she's close to you. Y'all are friends. I love that lady.
Yeah, she's amazing.
She is. Oh my goodness. She's like incredible. She's an EMDR therapist as well. And Santray, like all of it, registered play therapist. Before we I get off on such a tangent. Before we finish up, I want to make sure people know where to find you, to learn more from you, or to book a retreat, whatever it is that you have to offer. What is a website that they can go to or place to
Yeah,
get more information?
they can go to my website. That's just my name, MarshallLyles, .com, and they can find me there. I'm not on social media anymore, so that has a way to email me. And then once a week, I send out little newsletters of, it's often just a little moment of encouragement or a poem, but other times I remember to tell people about things I'm doing. So you can get on that newsletter list. On the website, and then from my that website, there's also a link over to the Marshall's Miniatures, which is really much more my wife's domain. She, if you ever email Marshall's Miniatures, you're really emailing Heather, and she can answer all your questions.
I love Heather. I love Heather. I love all y'all. And I just to say the poetry thing, and get one more tangent. Like on my timeline, there is a before Marshall and after Marshall, and then there's another little before Marshall teaching Jackie poetry, and after, like I have incorporated poetry into even my vacations. I went on vacation with some friends, and I wrote poetry every day and read it to them. I've been using it in therapy. I've been using it in some of my marketing of my things, and just personally and in my journaling. So thank you, like thank you
Have
so
you
much.
yet called yourself a poet? I've been waiting for you to say that word, and I haven't heard you say it yet.
Oh my gosh, I just got like something happened in my body when you said that.
Yeah, you've become a poet.
Wow, gosh. What are the what's the requirements to be a poet?
To be a poet is less about how you write or what you write, and it has a lot to do with how you see the world. You know, do you walk around letting a moment elongate? You know, do you see not just the literal, but the metaphorical, you know, and embedded in the moment? So I think there's so that's just so much about how you exist inside a space, how you make peace with the sensory moments of the world, how you know how to both use words to ground, contain, amplify. You know, that it's the experience of how you live in the spaces that you go to that really make you a poet.
Okay, I think I'm a poet. I may not. Well, I mean, who's to say good. I'm improving. I'm in progress. But I think I'm a poet. I could even write a like some poetry about this experience, even with the dog barking, like the whole nine yards. Okay, I guess I'm a poet. I might even put that on my curriculum vitae.
I love it. That would make me so happy.
Oh, Marshall, thank you so much. And I appreciate it. Until next time, friend. Bye bye.
Bye.